Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I am Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is New Century Urban Development, Economics and the Environment, with Claude Gouin, our speaker, and Gabriel Metcalf, our moderator. It is with great pleasure that I introduce you to Gabriel Metcalf, the Executive Director of SPUR, and a highly respected leader in urban affairs and development in San Francisco, the Bay Area, and California. And he will introduce our speaker. Gabriel?
Thank you very much for organizing this session. Thank you all for coming here. Claude Gouin is the principal economist of Gouin & Gouin, a firm that's been in business since 1970. In that capacity, he has consulted all over the country and beyond. It is a real honor to be the moderator of this. I have been an admirer of his work for a long time, as I know many of you have as well. We are in for a real treat. So this is a talk, at least partly based on the book, New Urban Development, Looking Back to See Forward. If any of you don't have it yet, you should get it. It is really worth a read. We're going to hear from Dr. Gouin. And after that, we're going to turn to questions. So you write them here, and we'll grab them and pass them to the front. And I think we're going to have a really good discussion. So without further ado, I present to you Claude Gouin.
Welcome, welcome, and thank you very much for coming. And Anne, thank you very much for allowing me to be a part of the Visions program. And I particularly want to thank Gabriel for not only being here, but making an introduction. And he asked me what I wanted in an introduction, and I said, brevity. And, and he did that very well, though not, I think, as well as another speaker who introduced me. And the speaker pointed to me and said, in by way of introduction, he said, Claude Gouin is an economist. Those are forecasters who are put on the earth to make meteorologists look good. So our natural resource base and the urban public's access to it would be much smaller without the achievements of environmental organizations. Their fight for the sustainability of the natural environment picked up speed in the later half of the 20th century, pushed along after Rachel Carson's Silent Spring was published. Also in the 1960s, Jane Jacobs' The Life and Death of Great American Cities and Lewis Mumford's The Highway and the City moved on urban environmental activists that have preserved much of what urban residents enjoy today. Often the same people were in both environmental movements. When Kay Kerr and the other founders of the now famous Save the Bay Coalition began their epic fight against filling in San Francisco Bay in order to create more land for development, environmentalists concerned primarily with the natural environment saw her group as their allies and often joined the Save the Bay group. Such alliances stayed in place as the nature of the urban battle expanded from stopping changes that would worsen all urban life to preserving the built status quo and enhancing the values of incumbent neighbors. That expansion of what they were doing had unintended consequences that I'd like to comment on tonight. The political, legal, and attitudinal changes that environmental alliances occurred largely before the two great threats to the natural and political society were recognized. I'm talking, of course, about the likelihood of greenhouse gases and other pollutants causing climatic change. And secondly, the very real danger that the fabric of our democratic society will be ripped apart by the pattern of income inequality that has become increasingly evident since the turn of the century. Avoiding a global doomsday from continued gas emissions will be more difficult and expensive than the battle environmentalists fought and won in the 20th century. In addition to a carbon tax, to change the source of both energy purchases by consumers as well as energy purchases by business, the final victory over global warming will have to include the invention of much more efficient technologies. Today's carbon-free generators are like the Stanley steamers that were made obsolete by the internal combustion engine. The current crop of solar, wind, and similar non-polluting energy producers will only be fruitful if they lead to something more efficient as well as being non-greenhouse gas emitting. The time has come for the federal government to stop subsidizing the construction of the current state-of-the-art wind and solar projects and begin spending billions in a new type of Manhattan projects to invent relatively cheap non-greenhouse gas emitting sources and anti-brightening and other technologies to mitigate the greenhouse warming effects already present. We also need to stop programs whose costs outweigh their benefits. One example is the subsidization of ethanol from corn and other plants. In the U.S., where currently about 40% of our corn crop is being used to produce biofuels instead of food, the price of corn has climbed over $7 a bushel. The result, of course, is higher cereal and livestock prices in the U.S. Globally, the price has also soared in countries like Guatemala, where the rural poor subsist largely on corn-based diets. And today, roughly 50% of children in Guatemala are undernourished. These are just some examples of such inefficient and inequitable programs aimed at global warming. Recent estimates suggest that in order to take effective action, which in my mind should include a carbon tax, will be over $670 billion per year. And this is exclusive of rebates for those who cannot afford to pay the higher costs inevitably caused by things such as a carbon tax. The current temper of Washington policy suggests we cannot move quickly to a high and very effective carbon tax, such as Ireland has imposed. But a very small carbon tax, of perhaps only a few cents, programmed to increase in the future, is worth fighting for now, to begin leveling the energy playing field. The only way we'll be able to pay all the costs, some of which I've alluded to above, is with significant decreases in our standard of living or accelerated economic growth. I favor the latter. Fortunately, man's oldest social tool for improving human conditions can be used to provide the economic growth needed to finance the winning battle against global warming while simultaneously lessening the cost of such a victory. To quote Rachel Kite, the Vice President for Sustainable Development for the World Bank, cities are powerhouses of economic production. They consume two-thirds of the world's energy and produce 80% of its greenhouse gases. Furthermore, and this was not the case in the early years of the environmental movement, the demographic makeup and priorities of today's urban consumers and workers create demands for new activity centers that cluster housing, work, and commercial space, thereby reducing the generation of greenhouse gases. Just as Willie Horton robbed banks because, as he explained, that's where the money is, environmentalists fighting global warming can say about cities, that's where we can find economic growth and development patterns that will win the battle against global warming. But to make that potential a reality, environmentalists must work with their allies in cities to reform the current growth-limiting paradigm of laws and practices that govern land use development in some of the regions that have the greatest potential for growth. And this, incidentally, includes the Bay Area. When I first wrote an essay suggesting that steps in the United States would have to be taken to reset the development policies of our urban regions in order to provide the social and economic capital that makes them potential growth catalysts, my friend who's here tonight, Paul Sack, wrote an email back saying, "Claude, where do you think you are, Singapore?" Paul understood the economic and environmental example provided by Singapore. Since 1960, when 68% of Singapore's 1.9 million residents lived as squatters and squalor communities, it has grown to a population of 5.3 million, most of whom live in housing usually clustered with 70 to 250,000 people in a community, with ready access to mass transit, ability to walk to work, shopping, and cultural venues. In the 1960s, Singapore's per capita gross domestic income was near the bottom of the international scale of prosperity when measured with that, in that manner. Since then, it has climbed by a factor of 12 to be the world's fourth richest nation with a per capita GDP of over $60,000 per person. The World Bank estimates that the per capita GDP in the United States is $48,000 per person, making us the eighth richest nation when measured in terms of per capita GDP. All of America's urban places take up only 2.6% of America's total land area. That is 60 million acres out of 2.3 billion acres. These urban places are in 366 metropolitan areas, housing 80% of our population, producing 87% of our economic output. However, this growth is not spread evenly about those 366 places. Economic output, instead, slightly over half of the nation's GDP, over 50% of the GDP, is produced in only 24 of our 366 metropolitan areas. These 24 urban economic generators house 39% of the nation's population and 40% of the country's jobs. The ability of these 24 urban areas to generate economic growth and innovation comes from the unique combination of people working and continuing to work in close proximity to each other, so that the whole of the area produces and innovates more than simply the sum of its parts. Alfred Marshall first identified this phenomenon in 1890 and called it agglomeration economies. As the engines of agglomeration economies grow, they tend to become more powerful, which ratchets up the rate of growth. But as cities increase in size, their agglomeration economies are subject to becoming more expensive to operate. In time, this can throttle their growth and eventually weaken the engines so that its power actually declines. These are the unintended consequences that I mentioned earlier. One of the Bay Area's most important agglomerations is referred to as Silicon Valley, though as we all know, actually, it inhabits more than just the former orange groves of Santa Clara County and the industrial park next to the Stanford University. At one time, this agglomeration produced computers, hardware, as well as software. But as housing prices and related real estate costs escalated, that agglomeration lost its comparative advantage to produce hardware and spun off that aspect of its productive power to less expensive agglomerations elsewhere. These included, of course, places such as transit-served workplaces in Singapore and China, built with relative high density and close to shopping and entertainment. That experience has shown the leaders of the high-tech industry that constraining growth for residential and non-residential development increases their cost of operation. That's why Carl Garadino, the president and CEO of the Silicon Valley Leadership Council, is such a strong supporter of Senate Bill 731, authored by Senator Daryl Steinberg, to modernize the California Environmental Quality Act of 1975, in an effort to curb its use to stop, delay, and raise the cost of deeded environmentally desirable projects, something John Nex never thought it would be used for when he authored that act. While those concerned with maintaining the economic growth trend of the region, such as San Francisco, have criticized the current draft of SB 731 for not having gone far enough, the opposition to that bill that comes from environmental groups shows a total lack of understanding of what is needed to defeat global warming and make our democratic society sustainable. In fighting SB 731's attempt to lessen the abuses of CEQA, the environmental groups such as the Sierra Club are like the general seeking to fight the new war with the outmoded and obsolete weapons of the last war. While the growth-constraining policies emanating from City Hall have grown much worse over the years, I heard some early examples of this when, as it began to happen. I heard one example when a developer for whom we had programmed, we'd done market study, programming a new development, came into my office with his eyes popping to complain that when he had visited his site, he found pickets in support of a referendum to overturn the project's approval, marching up and down in front of his project. I rather smugly turned to him and said, well, you know, that's the way things are going nowadays. You should expect that. He looked at me with temper flaring, and he responded, yes, but I didn't expect to see my wife on the picket line. A much less humorous, but early example of the way environmental laws are being used to increase development costs and delays occurred when my firm completed an environmental impact analysis for a large project in a suburban community that was expanding what had once been a village into a major employment center here in the Bay region. The project would eventually evolve into a large mixed-use development that included all uses near both BART and two major freeways. The propinquity of working, shopping, and housing and its proximity to transit have created carbon-minimizing transportation effects as well as improvement in the town's housing balance. Upon submission of our environmental impact analysis, the local NIMBYs and their environmental allies filed a lawsuit contending that the EIR was inadequate. A protracted and expensive legal battle ensued, ending in a trial at which I testified in support of the EIR. The court ruled the EIR was adequate, and my head swelled with the pride of one who felt vindicated. As is often the case, such hubris leads to a downfall. After the judge's decision, a representative of NIMBY's law firm informed me that unless my client wrote his firm a check for $200,000, they would further delay the project by appealing the judge's decision. I responded smugly that he should put his appellate brief where the sun doesn't shine and walked off. The next day, my client stormed into my office screaming invectives at me, the kindest of which was that I was a stupid idiot. The client explained that he had already ordered several $1 million worth of steel and insisted that I not only apologize for the attorney but assure him that the check was in the mail. To stop such abuses, and many similar ones, will provide a twofer. In addition to providing the resources needed to defeat global warming, escalating economic growth in the only places it could occur is also the first of a two-step process to reverse the trend of income inequality. The second step needed to reduce income inequality is to increase efforts to provide practical, tacit information to the young and those who are underemployed and unemployed on the availability of good jobs that don't require a college education. To learn how to obtain these jobs and related business opportunities, as well as the skills needed to succeed in these jobs. But more on that later. Allow me first to elaborate on one aspect of the recent effect of the land use paradigm here in the Bay Area. The housing bubble burst actually aided the growth of the Silicon Valley agglomeration by causing an unfortunately temporary halt to the housing price escalation kicked off by the slow growth policies that began in the 1970s. If the region goes back to the housing constraint policies that most Bay Area communities have followed since the 1970s, they will reset the brake on the expansion and rate of increasing economic output. Already we are seeing signs of rents and for sale housing prices climbing back to where they were, taking between 35 and up to 50% of a worker's salary. The good news is that we are now seeing a significant increase in housing production within the Bay region. Unfortunately, this construction is the result of three unique factors, not likely to be present in the future. First, the financial freeze on loans and uncertainty prices led to an even greater usual undersupply of new housing during the recession, during essentially the pause. Secondly, as the economy began to recover, prices and rents rose faster than construction costs and interest rates. Finally, and most importantly, organizations, including the San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association, led by Gabriel, today's moderator, had unusual success in their campaign for planning and zoning expansions for relatively high-density housing near jobs, shopping, and recreational use. The surge of prices for the most for existing houses, I want to repeat that, the surge of prices for most existing houses we are now seeing will be tapped down or at least held steady when all the construction now coming out of the ground hits the market. But the salutary halt to housing prices will be temporary unless we act further. The loosening of zoning and the elimination of planning practices that constrain urban development are allowed to build has not been great enough to enable the new supply to keep up with the demand in the future. We are seeing a temporary solution to a problem, but not a long-term solution to the problem. At the beginning of the 20th century, the average American family living in cities spent 23% of their income for housing. By 2002, and this was before the housing bubble really blew up, the average household had climbed to over 33%. While I don't expect the housing prices to drop anything like food, which has decreased 85% over the last 100 years, the cost of housing could stop going up. As anyone who lives in San Francisco or this region knows, housing is not the only land use subjected to cost-raising delays and supply-limiting regulations. All urban land uses in growth-constrained cities like San Francisco are overpriced because our planning laws and political decisions keeps them underbuilt. The result not only hobbles our rate of growth, but over time hollows out our city's middle class and exacerbates the chasm of income inequities they have seen since the 21st century. Setting up the expansion of economic growth by modernizing the existing regulations paradigm may at first seem as though we are rigging the game to put more money in the pockets of developers and landlords. Actually, over time, the economic jiu-jitsu of competition will have the opposite effect by increasing the competition among builders and owners of urban space so as to decrease what houses and businesses have to pay for their residents, particularly for existing residents, with actions such as, number one, allowing mixed-use relatively high-density development in enough sites to permit the supply of new housing to exceed demand growth. Two, replacing our inclusionary zoning that requires a percentage of below market priced housing to be included with new market housing, replacing it with social housing programs that enable low and moderate income households access to existing as well as new rental ownership housing. Fixing the zoning rules for suburban development to mandate maximum rather than minimum lot sizes, thereby removing the so-called sprawl abuse that crippled suburban development. While removing the brakes that local land use regulations are now putting on faster economic growth can provide the resources needed to deal with global warming, by itself, more economic growth cannot resolve the problem of underemployment and unemployment that causes much of the income inequality in the United States. We cannot continue to depend on Pell Grants, loans, and exhortations that everyone must go to college in order to provide practical or tacit knowledge of what jobs are, how to get them, and how to benefit from them. That requires more of the type of programs exemplified by some of the people that are in the room here tonight. We're fortunate enough to have Tony DiStefano here with us. He's the executive director of the Enterprise for High School Students. This is a program that helps youths discover opportunities and cultivate their individual interests through training, guidance, and employment experiences in diverse and opportunity ways. 60% of the youth in the program comes with households receiving public assistance, and 18% of them are born outside of the United States. 20% live in public housing, and 52% live in homes with language other than English spoken. The program has been in existence in San Francisco for 43 years, during which it has worked with 20,000 youths, introducing them to career choices and helping them obtain the skills needed to find and secure jobs. Another example of a successful local program providing the kind of practical education that is required is La Cochina. This is a Mexican district, a Mission District community program cultivating food entrepreneurships that has already created over 90 jobs while expanding the activities of more than 33 businesses. Many of these businesses started in the kitchens of family homes, but they have now since opened restaurants. There's a kiosk at the Ferry Building, and successful food processing and packaging businesses have been started. The food products published by these entrepreneurs are now being sold by stores that include Safeway and Walmart. The director of another practical program, Jeannie Allen, is also here with us along with her husband, Mark. Mark and Jeannie have learned the secrets of establishing and running a successful fashion apparel design, manufacturing, and retail business. Some of the ladies in this room I know have worn Jean Mark clothing. Jean and her team are now teaching these secrets to local designers. This city-supported incubator is not a network of high-tech entrepreneurs, which, as we know, are also thriving in some local venues. It is dedicated to training designers to successfully run their own fashion business. Modeled after a fashion incubator in Chicago on State Street, the program is currently training 6 designers a year. If they are as successful as the Chicago incubator has been, 85% of these designers will wind up running their own successful businesses. Obviously, I could babble on more about these programs, but because we have the experts here during the discussion period, in addition to asking me questions about what I've said, feel free to ask questions about the programs. To sum up prior to the further discussion, changes in our land use laws and planning practices can provide the additional resources needed to invent the technologies and create the incentives to replace carbon fuels, while permitting changes in the urban landscape that will make it a more efficient energy source, energy user. The resulting increase in work opportunities, when coupled with practical job training, can help narrow the chasm of income inequality. Together, they can achieve what I hope you will agree is a good definition of sustainability: the opportunity of living in a well-protected environment that offers an equality of opportunity for economic mobility and a high quality of life. Thank you.
Okay, that was great. And everybody, fill out your questions. I am going to, take liberties with these.
We need to take a moment to remind our radio audience this is the Commonwealth Club of California, and our program tonight is New Century Urban Development, Economics and Environment with Claude Gwynne, and who's our speaker, and Gabriel Medcalf, who is our moderator. So again, this is the Commonwealth Club of California.
Okay, thank you. So again, fill these out. I will combine questions and elaborate on them and, do all of that. But this is the focus now for us. So Claude Gruen, first question. Any economist would say that the first best solution for dealing with an issue like climate change is to correct the externalities through a carbon tax. Maybe the second best would be a kludgier system, but still one that prices carbon, like a cap and trade. But what if politically neither of those happens and you're looking at a third or fourth or fifth best option? Do you think that California should begin to prohibit car-intensive development patterns, knowing that the prices of will be wrong, that there will be big externalities that still make sprawl appear to be affordable?
No. the temptation is certainly there. But what it boils down to, both economically, socially, and over time even politically, simply banning the car does not solve any problems. What it does is make it more difficult for people and ultimately destroy our economy. This is particularly true today when we're already seeing changes take place both in the technology. Talking about the car, for example, very quickly, Google has been trying a car that drives itself. is safer than people driving it, and of course it operates much more efficiently and safely. This is just one of the innovations that we see taking place. I guess I believe that, and when you mention sprawl, sprawl is only a problem to the degree it uses land inefficiently and inequitably. In other words, when we set up zoning rules that say whether we do it through, as George Miller told me, whether we do it through septic tanks or whether we do it by zoning so many per acres, and what communities do throughout the United States is to require a minimum of zoning. For example, we overzone 1, 2, and 3, and 4 acre lots to be more than what would be demanded, and we underzone the 12 and 14 units to the acre, which, because of the price, are demanded. That does two things. First of all, it uses land very inefficiently. Secondly, it means that the poor pay more for a square foot of land. With one stroke of the pen, the California legislature could simply require a default zoning of, say, 14 units to the acre and allow people, if they want to buy two lots, fine. But then they have to pay on a per square foot basis for those two lots. Doing that would solve 90% of the problems that people assign to sprawl. I mentioned these two innovations, and that one is a innovation. The other is a planning innovation, to suggest that we have solutions to the problem. And we've got to deal with the problem instead of pretending we can simply outlaw it.
Okay. Claude Gruen, given your emphasis on the fundamental supply-demand dynamics that make San Francisco so expensive, how many units a year does the city really need to be producing to make a significant dent in housing costs, to make average housing costs more affordable to people?
20 or 30 years ago, I could have known that answer because we did that, and I think you probably know it better than I do. But it's something like twice the number of units that were actually produced during a good year, which is one of the reasons why I think inclusionary zoning makes no sense at all, because that has the effect of reducing what the total production is. I frankly don't have a number, but I think you guys at Spur probably are in a better position to guess that than I am.
See me after the program. In order to get the expansion of the kind of high-density housing that would deal with the supply-demand imbalance, do we need to expand higher-density housing into the single-family home areas such as Pacific Heights, the Presidio area, and the Marina? Will that be necessary or not?
Yes, we have to expand them into some of the single family. As a matter of fact, many of the single family units that we want to save much replaced previous units. So cities are constantly changing. But I think it's hard to say, do we start at Pacific Heights? I don't want to exclude Pacific Heights, but I think one of the things we have to do is look at the city as a whole and look at those areas, number one, where it's starting to happen naturally and let it happen. And then also obviously consider what the economics are. Frankly, Recently, MTC and ABAG have done some planning efforts, and they picked PDAs, priority development areas. I think to a degree, they were on the right track. They didn't go nearly far enough, didn't do really enough of the analysis, but certainly the track they were on is to look at those neighborhoods where the economics is such this is going to happen anyway and encourage it.
What do you think about congestion pricing, road tolling, and other price mechanisms for allocating road space?
I think they make sense. Again, the only problem with them is I don't think you can do that alone. But I think we do have to increase our infrastructure. We certainly have to improve. I mean, I don't see it. There would be nothing wrong with spending money in San Francisco to fill potholes, for example. On the other hand, certainly in the interim, between now and when we can develop the technology and the infrastructure needed to deal with the problem of congestion, I think we can certainly use as an interim congestion pricing to at least spread it even.
Okay, you heard it here. A question, you talked a lot about the problem of income inequality and what it really takes to help lift people out of poverty and give people that opportunity at least. So a question basically saying we see that income inequality has been increasing, not decreasing, that the United States is becoming a less equal society. Why is that, and what can be done to reverse that?
Oh, wow.
A small question for the economist.
Right. Certainly, we have seen the economy change dramatically, not only because of technological change that have spurred quickly, but because of globalization. That means we have a major shift in the potential types of jobs we have, and we have not come close to matching a shift in what people know about jobs and work with that change. We've allowed the technology, but we've depended by and large on the universities to provide the kind of general education they do in order to give people what they need. If I can just go back, I think it was the day before yesterday or so, on David Brooks in the New York Times wrote an article, and I really wrote my speech before he did, but in which he said what we need is practical education, or tacit education is what I've been calling it. In other words, not the kind of stuff that is codified in books and that can be taught as general knowledge, but the kind of secrets that Jeannie Allen and Mark Grant know about their business that really can't be taught is practically in a university. The kind of secrets that Tony and his people know about what jobs are available, and I could give many examples, but I don't want to take the time, that there are plenty of jobs that do not require or even benefit from a four-year education. We have done virtually only a small bit of what is required to give people that kind of information and knowledge. Interestingly, and in my opinion, sadly, if you look at today's New York Times, there are three letters, all from professors, all writing that David Brooks is wrong. The colleges should not be doing this sort of thing. Well, the fact of the matter is that they're not going to be doing these things. And we need to do it, and I think this is something that cities can do best. When one of the first jobs I had in San Francisco was looking at the economics of the workplace here in San Francisco. And it was possible to see, for example, that at that time, tourism was our number one industry in San Francisco. The clothing industry was number two. But the kind of clothing that was being developed there and the way it was being done obviously did not have a long time life and could not compete with the kind of labor they have in China. And incidentally, at the same time, we were increasing our work rules, making it even more difficult for that to happen. So it was pretty obvious that we'd have to either get out of that business, or largely, obviously there's some of it still straggling by, or change things. Well, we didn't change things until programs such as what Jeannie Allen and Mark Grant are doing today to teach people how to basically do a kind of boutique clothing business. Now, that's just one example out of many. And we cities are ideal to do that because each city has its own unique culture and its own unique workplace. One of the things I try to do when we work for cities is tell councils or supervisors, you know, don't just run around to other places and try to do what they do. You can go to other places, but recognize that with the kind of comparative advantages you have, the kind of geography you have, the culture you have is unique. Learn what job opportunities there are in that unique period. Make people aware of things like the healthcare opportunities we have here in the Bay Area. Show them how to get those jobs, and we can solve that problem. Unfortunately, this is a two-step progress. We first have to allow the flexibility of development to make those communities that are able to develop more quickly, and then we have to do the kind of practical training that is not being done anywhere today.
Okay, what an interesting answer. All right, Dr. Gruen, we have a self-help question for you. You noted that present solar power will soon become obsolete. For the long-term benefit, does it make sense for my condo building to pursue solar power now or wait for new technology before investing?
I wish I could answer, but the thing we don't know is how long will it take for the new technology to come up. Your guess is really as good as mine. I do believe we've got to at least invest the I mean, after all, we were able to invest the equivalent of tens of billions of dollars in developing the most deadly weapon the world has ever had during World War II. I think we've got to have similar kind of effort spent to develop the new technology. I have no idea how long it will take. I don't have the codified technical knowledge that would answer that. But I think it's worth a shot. And in the meantime, you probably can benefit from the kind of subsidies that are being poured into solar energy today. Subsidies, incidentally, that are going to be around for a long time, because utilities in California are being required to buy 33% of their power by alternative sources I think it's 2020. Now, what that means is that the utilities are being required to buy power that's going to cost 25 to 30% more than what they can get through gas. And when that power begins to go to the public, obviously it's going to increase our costs. So again, you may be better off with the solar, but I think it's basically a short-run solution, but who knows how long it's going to take before the technology will get where it should be.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Claude Gwynn, our speaker, and Gabriel Metcalf, our moderator. The nice thing about being chair of a meeting is that I get to ask a question. So I have a question. Actually, I have two, but let me ask the first one. How will middle-class people be able to buy homes in San Francisco with the large amount of foreign cash being brought into our housing market from foreign investors? In other words, a foreign person investing in San Francisco, which is being done more and more and more, can put down all the cash needed to buy a home, whereas many of us need to, in fact, put a deposit down and get a mortgage.
Good question. Obviously, like London, New York, San Francisco is getting foreign dollars coming in to people that are frequently living in houses only part of the time. And that's what you're talking about. Having said that, let's begin with realize, to me, the first answer is to take their money and realize that not all of those buildings are going to fill in for people from overseas, and some of the people from overseas will wind up doing what they do in London and another place, which is lease out their houses to part of the time. That then will take some of the pressure off the existing stock. Now, those of you looking at me, you're right. I am old, but in spite of my age, the first new house I ever lived in was a house here in San Francisco, or dwelling isn't a house; it's a condo here in San Francisco that we bought a little over 5 years ago. I managed to survive for many, many years living in existing housings. And I don't have a housing virginity complex, and I suspect most of us don't. So I think the answer is go ahead and take their money, but allow that money to be spent on an increase in housing production. This will create housing, that some of which will be used locally, some of which will be rented out. And over time, this increasingly frees up the number of people in existing housing. And I think that is the only way that we've ever really seen any city in the world produce anything close to affordable housing.
Okay. I'm going to ask one of my questions. You spoke a lot about agglomeration economies. The old-fashioned term for that was sometimes called industrial districts. One of my old planning school professors, Mike Teets, did a study of agglomeration districts. And he says, in history, going back hundreds of years, they never last more than 70 or 100 years. How much longer do we have on Silicon Valley?
First of all, I think Mike is right. He's also a friend of mine. How much longer we have depends upon whether or not we allow Silicon Valley to change. In other words, if you can morph, It isn't that industrial districts are going to live forever. It's that they change. Some of the industrial districts that we had in the past will go wind up being activity centers with shopping and housing in them. At least that's what should happen. If you allow districts to have flexibility, they will change. And just as if you look at the neighborhoods, somebody asked the question earlier about which neighborhood should we have more housing density today, and I said my answer is study the economics and then I'll know which neighborhoods you can do it. Actually, we did that in 1964 through the CRP program here in San Francisco. I think if you allow that to happen, the location of the high-tech industry will probably change. The kind of buildings they're in will probably change. The makeup of their workforce will probably change, but the agglomeration will still be here. If, on the other hand, we try to create districts, it's like I've talked a lot about incubators, and I believe in them, but I think it's a big mistake for cities to buy buildings or build buildings and then make them available very cheaply to people trying to do what Jeannie and Mark are trying to do. Because what happens to any industry is even Jeannie will not be 100% successful. Some of the people she trains will do well, others will not. But if you put them in a building where they have cheap rents, they'll all stay there forever. And you don't want that to happen. The same is true of districts. You want districts to change. By allowing flexibility, the industries will also change, but they will remain viable in the same general region.
Would you like to have people from these programs you're mentioning say a word?
I'd love it, yes.
Do you guys want to just say a quick word, tell us about what you do?
Yeah. Tell us who you are.
Okay. Well, Claude, we do turn them out after a year, so they can't stay there forever. I think what we're trying to do is, or the mission of our, it's a nonprofit, is to train designers, give them, they tend to be right-brain people, and we're trying to give them the accounting, the legal, all of those skills that you need to be a good business person so that can round out their business. And then their vision is to start a business here in San Francisco. And, of course, as they start their small business, then they hire accountants, they hire pattern makers, they hire representatives, and it starts a stone thrown into a pool, and they touch 19 other businesses. So it's not only that we are regenerating the fashion business in San Francisco, but we're also creating a fashion community. We not only train these six people every year, but we also offer a series of public programs that are available to all the designers in the Bay Area, and we do these once a month, and they will be on anything from costing your product so that you can be successful and make money to, you know, more. We just had one on Meet the Buyers. And so anyway, it is a broad-based program, and I think it's working.
Jeannie, for our radio audience, could you identify yourself and your firm?
Thank you. Yes. I'm Jean Allen. I'm Executive Director of the Fashion Incubator San Francisco.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Very impressive. Claude Gruen, we have a series of questions that are kind of about development and development politics and specific developments going on in San Francisco. So here's one. High-rise developments block people's access to sunshine in parts of San Francisco that have very little green space. How might San Francisco do better providing green open space downtown and in SoMa and similar areas where there will be a lot of development in the future?
Well, I think as a planner, part of laying out entitlement that provides enough sites to meet the demand requires the traditional. This is one of the reasons we need planners and we need government, is because you need to look at the pattern of development in order to provide open space, transportation, and the infrastructure that would be required. And incidentally, one of the reasons I wouldn't fight having the rich come in and pay for some of this is I do believe that if the infrastructure required is unique, the development should pay for that, for their part of that. Now, I want to be careful about this. We have a tendency in San Francisco to essentially make the new development pay for remedial help to the existing development. That's not what I'm saying. But I think if there's a true nexus that goes on, then the development should be made to pay its own way, and that includes providing adequate green space within a pattern that makes sense.
Okay.
Do we want to have Tony? Do you want to say a few words?
Hi, I'm Tony DiStefano. I'm the Executive Director of Enterprise for High School Students. Thanks very much for the opportunity. So I'm actually also a recovering CEO, recovering tech CEO. I retired from the business world 5 years ago and have been running Enterprise for High School Students since. We work with about 500 high school kids from dozens of schools across San Francisco every year to help them, as an ex-CEO, I can tell you, develop three of life's most important skills: how to get a job, how to keep a job, and then how to make that transition from high school onto what's next. And for a lot of the kids that we work with, college is what's next. But a great way to see it, as you were talking, Claude, is thinking, I want to quibble with you a little bit. So I'll give you Jordan as an example of a young man who went through an internship program that we do. As I say, we work with hundreds of kids a year. We train them in workshops, then they move on into the workplace. Typically, they're internships. So Jordan was a young man at Galileo High School. He had completed his junior year. He came from a working class family, didn't know anything at all about allied healthcare, but he knew through the workshops that allied healthcare is a growth area. So we have this great partnership with Kaiser. As Jordan is going through the program, what he sees is that he can become a phlebotomy tech without any college. He would go on to a certification program, a place like Phlebotomy Plus, and become a phlebotomy tech, and he also knows what those people make. Then he can look at a radiation tech, see what they make, and understand that it means going to City College, getting certificate, and unlike two-thirds of the kids who go to City College, completing the work. But he'll be going with a picture of why he's there, and that's what's so important, and that's the difference. Thirdly, Jordan could see that he can be an RN, go through a four-year program, and decide it's worth the investment, but again have a picture of what he wants to do. So that's the work that we do, and in Jordan's case, he decided he wanted to be a radiation tech, and he is. Thank you.
I do think we're on the same page, Tony, because it's interesting. First of all, once they are aware, having taught it, I've taught both at Xavier University and the University of California at California, and the students who come in knowing what they need to know are your best students. So I'm not suggesting that for those students who want that extra training, they can't go there. But you mentioned phlebotomy. It's interesting. I was sitting next to a lady. We were having the same discussion, and she said that she was working with a middle-aged man who decided he wanted to run an art gallery. But he said, I cannot support myself. I know I won't be able to, at least in the early years of running the art gallery. But that's really what I want to do. When he found out that if he got a certificate in phlebotomy, which again took, this is the ability to take blood at hospitals, it was a relatively short program. He could then earn enough to make his other goal. In other words, the kind of practical programs that you're doing don't exclude college, but when they lead to college, they usually make college more worthwhile. And if people don't want college, they still can make a good living.
Okay. Claude Gruen, you talked about the importance of growth in a dynamic economy like the Bay Area as part of a national strategy for economic progress. But what about the cities that are not economically successful, the Detroits and the Youngstowns and the whole list of cities that are losing jobs and are not centers of innovation? What should be done about those places?
First of all, I think that we recognize that they aren't all going to be able to graduate to the kind of agglomeration that 24 cities are going to have. In many cases, Youngstown being a good example, they will have to right size. That is, they have enough going for them so that they can support a population, but not the same size that when we lived in Ohio, it isn't there. However, again, as Youngstown right sizes and looks to what it can grow and the kind of training and the kind of culture it needs, it has a chance of growing again. Each of these cities is unique. Some of them will be able to go back, but it seems unlikely that they all will, which is one of the reasons why I argue so much for letting those cities that can grow, grow. The one thing that we've seen, there's a paper out on this now. I think it was a couple of professors at Harvard, and I've seen an advanced copy. One of the things we've had going on in the United States for 100 years is an evening of wages as people moved. In other words, when the economies of New England began to decline, people moved to some of the states where the economy grew, not the least of which, of course, was California. That kind of shift in population has enabled the general economy to increase, and also it caused our wages to increase. But it did require that people have to be able to move. And one of the problems of having such high housing prices as we have in places like San Francisco, it's increasingly difficult for people to move. So what I'm saying is, no, we can't. There's no magic wand that we can turn all cities into the 24 greatest. But we can all benefit if we allow those cities that have the potential to make that potential true, and they will draw some of the people from the Detroits and the Rochesters and the Buffaloes.
Claude Gruen, we have a couple of minutes left. Would you like to make any closing comments?
Well, again, thank you. In terms of closing comments, I think we have to recognize that change ultimately is going to be difficult. But if we don't change the rules of the games in those urban places that are our hope, both in terms of resources and in terms of society, I think we can then look to globalization and the technology as essentially working against us over time. I think we have a choice. And whether we're talking about urban development or healthcare or anything else, we have to recognize that in a global economy, we ultimately have to be able to sell things overseas, because right now, for years, we are borrowing from the Chinese, from the Germans, the money that we're using. And just as the kind of housing affordability that we thought we had with the loans that people couldn't repay, the things that don't look like they can last forever won't. Our ability to have the rest of the world finance us will not go on forever. The only solution, thus, to both the global problems and the economic problem is to allow those cities that can change to change and work this kind of competitive jiu-jitsu, so that, in fact, while the developers are working to make money for themselves, they create the kind of additional space and the kind of flexibility space that will solve not only the global warming problems, but the very real problems that society has to provide if we're going to continue to live with each other under a democratic system.
As chair of the meeting, I'm not going to let Gabriel Metcalf off the hook. I mean, he's the executive director of SPUR and a highly respected leader in urban affairs and development. So, Gabriel, your final comments and observations?
Well, I really appreciate the work of Claude Gruen helping us helping us understand the economy and the way cities work, really. You know, this is San Francisco is a very progressive town, right? Ralph Nader got more votes for the Green Party than the Republican Party got the year he was on the ballot. We are the only city of any significant size in America that can claim that. This is a town where at one time a majority of the sitting members of the Board of Supervisors, I believe, identified as being anti-capitalist. Now, just a factual observation. To the progressive members of our community who are critical of capitalism as a system, I would note that Karl Marx devoted his life to understanding the mechanisms of capitalism, and that some of them would be wise to spend some more time at their studies about the way markets work. Now, I happen to be someone who I find the ideas in this book inspiring, practical, helpful, but even people who think they want to sign up for a different approach should spend some time thinking about this. Thank you for what you've done.
Thank you.
On behalf... On behalf of the Commonwealth Club and our radio audience, our thanks to Claude Gwynne, our speaker, and Gabriel Metcalf, our moderator, for an excellent discussion of New Century Urban Development, Economics, and the Environment. If you would like more information, Dr. Gwynne's book, New Urban Development, Looking Back to See the Future, is available from rutgerspress.rutgers.edu. I'm Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Forum. I look forward to your joining us for new visions for the environment and the economies and cities and other urban and non-urban areas that we live in. So please join us as we explore new visions. At this time, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 110 years of enlightened discussion, and I wish to reassure you that I haven't been around for all 110 years, in the know is adjourned. We look forward to seeing you and hearing from you at our upcoming meetings.
Thank you.